Hey, everybody. Welcome to our first episode of the Vitalist Spark podcast. In this episode, we're going to peel back the layers of the relationship between transportation and health in our communities. Now, when it comes to well-being and health, nothing could be more recommended than play, or plays for that matter. So let's jump right in and find out what happens when theater meets transportation. My name is John Ford, and we have two guests with us today. We have Xanthia Walker, and we have Paula Ortega from Rising Youth Theater. Welcome, you guys.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you so much for being here. Did you get here by light rail?
I wish we could say that. We didn't. Not today.
No performances today?
I reached Xanthia through the light rail.
See?
To get to her.
All right, let's get into the topic here. What in the heck is a light rail play?
So light rail plays are 5-minute performances that take place in the light rail and on the light rail platform. And it's a youth artist and an adult artist creating a play, their own play.
We usually have 8 plays, so that's 8 teams of youth artists and adult artists. And then we also have a band of tour guides that is literally a band. They're musicians, and they take the audience through all of the plays and also play music during them.
That's awesome. So like, what kind of instruments are they carting around?
Well, last year we had a guitar and a clarinet and
ukulele,
percussion. We had ukuleles. Yes.
Oh yeah.
Excellent. No cymbals though, right? None of that crashing.
No cymbals. We don't want to be abrasive. We want to be delightful. There's something delightful about a clarinet.
You know what? Isn't the most important thing to be delightful?
Yes. Delightful and.
Delightful and what? Delightful and maybe...
Delightful and centering the powerful stories of young people in a public platform.
Nice. So talk a little bit about that. How does that happen? How do you make that work?
Well, Rising Youth Theater, our mission is centered on that work, on theater as a powerful tool for young people sharing their stories and experiences in a way that they can be heard and seen and respected for their ideas and their expertise. And so in our processes, we always, we center those experiences and voices as catalysts for all of our work.
Hence the name Rising Youth Theater. It all makes sense now. All right, so what about the challenges for you all as artists and performers? Or is it not challenging, but more actually freeing and exciting? I mean, there is no stage left, there is no stage right, there is no dressing room. The director can't even hide in the corner and give you signals. I mean, does that make it fun?
Makes it challenging.
Yeah, I'll bet.
Yeah, because there's no script as well. It's our own words, our own movements. And even if you get it wrong, people won't know. Not even the director.
Is it more improv then?
I wouldn't call it improvised. I would say like we create it originally. So the actors are never handed a script that says like these are your lines. We build what the lines are through a series of writing exercises and improvisations, and eventually it gets set. But we try it on the train significant numbers of times before it gets set. So that experimentation process is never only a rehearsal. There's always an audience.
So there really is no finished product. It's continuously evolving.
Well, it gets set towards the end of when we go into official performances. I'm doing air quotes. You can't see me. But it gets set by then. But it is a highly flexible and evolving thing, even when it is set, because the audience is always different. And the energy is always different. And, you know, it depends. It's really different if there's 5 people on the train or if there's 50 people on the train. And all of those things change the experience of performing. And that's what's exciting about it to me, is that the pieces have to be so responsive to whatever is happening on the train that day.
Looks do you get?
What kind of
How do people
do
respond?
They asked our price. Sometimes we had an issue, right, about some guy just going off in a performance because he wasn't like okay with that kind of type of thing, because it had to do with racism.
Oh.
Was the Tomas one?
You know, we get all kinds of reactions. Most of our reactions are really like surprised and delighted. But sometimes people are traveling and they're having a bad day and they don't want someone singing in their space. That's also totally legitimate. So there have been a couple moments where we've like been like, okay, thank you, and just shifted, you know, and gave a person who needed their space their space. But most of the time, people are really delighted to encounter the plays, or at least really surprised.
Yeah, they're excited to. They start to follow us after that.
Yeah, a lot of people sort of pick up the tour. Like, they'll see us on the train and then stay and watch the rest of the plays and follow it back around.
That's fantastic. All right, so you talked about this idea of themes, and you got a whole cycle of plays. So where did you go to get your themes, and with what purpose did you come up with those themes?
Well, we go to the space. A lot of the young people that we work with ride public transportation every day, and so they're community experts in what that experience is. And so when we're partnering youth and adult artists together, those two people then go on a research journey where they spend time on the trains and they have specific questions that they're looking to get answered. And then we kind of accumulate a pile of images and observations and writing and artifacts that we've collected from the space, which have ranged from like somebody's shoe to like piles and piles of light rail tickets to all kinds of things. And then from that pile, the ensemble, which is all of the eight teams together, and then also the design team, we see like kind of what sort of rises to the top of kind of that pile of stuff. Like, are there common threads? Are there questions that were answered in similar ways by multiple people? Are there resonant images that are coming out of all of that research?
So what'd you come up with? Themes do you tackle?
The last theme was what do you see outside?
Yeah, it was.
It's kind of like assuming.
It was like about seeing and unseeing.
Yeah, seeing and unseeing. That's it.
So who do you see and who don't you see, and how do you unsee or see?
In terms of social interaction on the train.
Well, that's
or in terms of life in general.
Well, social interaction on the train was definitely where that came from, but I think it can go broader and more universal than that too. And be about how we see people in our community or don't see them.
So when you throw these themes out and you do these plays, do you sort of see people's light bulbs go off over their heads? Do they start to understand? Do they walk off the train with a different perspective than when they walked on?
I think they do. One of my performances was about judging someone by just looking at them, such as like skin color and stuff. And I feel like people can really relate to that, but just assuming what kind of race someone is and just picking on them. I feel like they walk off by like just knowing that there's just not one race that has the same skin color. That there's more out there, and just to not assume.
I think it's always the hope of an artist, and especially artists that create original work based on people's truths and experiences. Like, we hope that when we make that work, people feel compelled to listen and to think about it after they walk away. So that's always the hope. And whether or not that's always achieved is a great question that I ask myself every day.
Beyond plays, there lies the very real work of making communities healthier through transportation options. That's the job of Leslie Dornfeld from Planet, a Phoenix-based firm with one purpose: reimagining and planning for high-quality communities. We got together with Leslie and our conversation started with a little bit of Arizona history.
When I got here, there was no sidewalk planning, no planning for pedestrians or bicycles. People thought it was too hot to walk. And it's actually gotten, the average temperatures have actually gotten hotter over the past 25 years, but more people are walking and we have better facilities for pedestrians and bicyclists. And also we have much more transit. We have light rail, which is breaking all records and expanding. We have bus service. We've instituted neighborhood circulators. And all of these kinds of things help make communities more accessible, and ultimately they make them more healthy too. You know, I think that Arizona was in many ways a victim of the time. We experienced huge population increases during the 80s and the early 90s, and during those times, health wasn't even part of the conversation. Nobody really even thought that how we designed communities could impact individual health and the health of a community.
Absolutely.
And so as a result, communities were largely built to accommodate cars, to move those vehicles quickly and move them around, and also to separate people from cars. So you'll see walls around subdivisions so people's backyards aren't adjacent to a roadway. Everything was oriented internally, and no one really thought about walking. So a lot of those decisions, I think, we're working to rectify and make better. We're looking at communities that are focusing on building pedestrian-oriented downtowns, increasing densities and mixing uses so that people don't have to drive everywhere they want to go, but people can make the choice to live in a place where they can walk to a restaurant or walk to the grocery store. And what we're finding is statistically, more and more and more people want that.
And that thought gave us the perfect opportunity to talk about complete streets. Now, what are complete streets? They are streets for everyone, designed and operated not just for cars, but also for pedestrians, bicyclists, motorists, and transit riders of all ages and abilities. Using complete streets policies and practices, transportation planners and engineers routinely design and operate the entire right-of-way to enable safe access for all users. This means that every transportation project will make the street network better and more equitable, and that makes our cities and towns better places to live. I asked Leslie about the opportunities complete streets provide.
A complete street is a street that provides as many modes of mobility as possible given that street. But on wider streets, streets that maybe are at the half mile or the mile, streets we typically call arterial, those mile streets and collector streets, there's real opportunities to provide a variety of transportation choices, in particular, a better walking environment, a better bike environment, and a better bus environment. And that way, people have choices. And with those choices, the community becomes more accessible. With a more accessible community, people have better access to things that directly affect their health, things like a doctor's office, a supermarket where they can get healthy food, a drugstore where they can fill their prescriptions. But if they also have those choices and they don't have to drive all the time, they're more physically active. And that increase in physical activity has a direct impact on obesity. And obesity-related diseases are a killer. They're chronic diseases that are reaching legion heights in the U.S. And studies have shown that communities which are more walkable and in places that are more walkable, people tend to have less obesity-related diseases, and they're healthier, and then they live longer.
We also talked about how complete streets work not only in big cities, but in rural parts of Arizona.
You know, a lot of people say, oh, it's a rural area, nobody walks. But a couple things I'd like to point out about Arizona, they may or may not be true elsewhere in the U.S. We have a huge percentage of our land that's devoted to Native American communities. And a lot of those communities, people do walk, and they walk along the sides of highways. And the death toll, especially at night in those areas, is usually quite high. And so that portion of the community really benefits from safer streets and streets that are more complete, streets that might offer a very wide shoulder. The Arizona Department of Transportation actually developed a policy. They call it a complete highways policy because they recognize that when highways go through downtowns and they typically need to improve highways because of increased traffic or other reasons, that a lot of times those downtowns can lose sidewalks or they can lose other amenities because the roadway needs to be built to standard.
So let me grab you right there, because we've heard this a number of times. Nogales, for example, just said to us, you know, we can't do anything with our downtown because it's a highway. Is it that they don't know about complete highways?
They probably don't. It's a really great policy. It looks at roadways based on the land uses that are around them and recognizes that it may not be able to be feasible to put in an 8-foot sidewalk, but a 4-foot sidewalk is better than no sidewalk at all.
So, and you've got a bunch of other rural areas, and you mentioned the reservations. I know I just had the opportunity to drive through the San Carlos Apache Reservation, and they have a beautiful bikeway. Beautiful bikeway right next to the state highway. It includes lighting about every 300 yards. I mean, it's fantastic. And so there are good things that are happening in Arizona. Payson, for example, has done a lot of work on their trail system, actually creating trails that lead to their schools so that kids can commute in ways other than by car. Other experiences you've seen around the state?
Yeah, I mean, Eager has a fantastic rails to trails. They're doing a lot to redevelop their downtown, as is Springerville. Places like we were talking about earlier, Globe and Miami, Superior, those smaller mining communities. Globe has just done a great job with their downtown and worked really hard on a pedestrian environment. A lot of these smaller mining communities have, Bisbee too, have the stair climbs,
right,
which encourages folks to really explore the downtown from a walking perspective. I think that what people need to realize is that you may have a car, but your 12-year-old doesn't. Or you may have a car, but there's going to be a time where your parent might need to walk somewhere, and they can't. And so people really need to realize that. I have a friend that says at some point in time, we are all disabled, and at some point in time, we're all going to need pedestrian facilities.
What Leslie is talking about is more broadly termed health equity. Health equity means that community well-being is addressed holistically, so every person has the opportunity for optimal health. Health equity work addresses the unfair and avoidable differences that we currently find in Arizona today, and it recognizes that communities can only make healthy choices when they have healthy options available to them. As a point of principle, health equity holds that no one should be denied the chance for a healthy life because of socioeconomic factors or lack of opportunities. Do you see an awareness when you go and talk to a street transportation department, do folks get that?
You know, I think that they do more and more. I think that they do. They're being taught that in school now. Engineering used to be all about efficiency. Now I think engineering is about efficiency and equity and humanity.
So then we talked about health impact assessments, or HIAs.
Health impact assessments are cool.
HIAs essentially function as an analysis of the health impacts that a past, current, or future decision has on residents' health and well-being. It could be an issue of air quality, mobility, living conditions, or any number of health-related circumstances.
A good example is we were looking at a project in northern Arizona, and the engineers thoughtfully put a pedestrian path to a hospital from a senior center, but that pedestrian path actually, even though it was direct, went across a wash. The seniors weren't going to cross the wash when it was raining. The wash was unstable. So we looked at it and said, you know, it's probably better to just get the seniors to the bus stop, let them take a bus to the hospital, because they can also take a bus to the market, take a bus to the community center. And those were the small kinds of changes that were made, and we realized the benefits from creating a pedestrian path that gave them access choices to different areas had bigger health impacts than a single path to a hospital.
So, where does Leslie net out on all of this?
And I'm a big believer, too, in what I call creeping incrementalism. I think that sometimes we are so tunnel visioned, and I would include myself in this, that we're unable to look at alternative situations or different ways of solving the problem. And if that means a facility that isn't everything you wanted it to be but still accomplishes the goal, if it means waiting a year to get what you want as opposed to getting it now, some of those kinds of trade-offs are really important and really effective ways of accomplishing your goals.
And what is Leslie's advice for you today?
You know, if you really are interested in creating a healthier community, I think the first assignment I would give you would be to pick a place to walk to or bike to.
And there we go.
Think about how that could be better. Is there a marked bike lane? Is the sidewalk level? Is it wide enough for you to walk with a friend and talk with them? Is it shaded? Are there direct connections, or can you even get to your local drugstore or a park? And that's, to me, the first thing is begin to think about your neighborhood and how could this affect you? How could, if you had a child, would you feel comfortable letting your child go there on their own if they were 10 or 11 or 12?
If you want to connect with the great work Leslie is doing, visit her website at planet.us. That's planet.us. Connect with national resources through the American Planning Association at planning.org and Smart Growth America at, you guessed it, smartgrowthamerica.org. Finally, you can get engaged with our state's very own Arizona Alliance for Livable Communities at livableaz.org. And now, let's get back to a little more fun with Rising Youth Theater's Light Rail Plays. So, because we're talking about a really amazing project, really, really cool, exciting, just totally fun. You guys put on plays on the light rail line.
Yes,
we do.
How did that happen? How did that start?
It was born out of an idea. Our company received the Mayor's Arts Award in theater about 5 years ago. And because we received an award from the mayor, we had a meeting with him, Mayor Stanton, and we were talking about our work and our commitment to removing barriers that people encounter when they think about, like, is theater something that is for me or not? Do I want to engage with an arts performance? And he said, sort of off the cuff, well, you know, it'd be really great to, like, do something on the light rail. Like, wouldn't it be fun to just have, like, a performance there? And we said, yeah, actually, that's a wonderful idea. Like, we're going to do it.
He's like an idea guy.
So we were really lucky because around the same time, the Arizona Commission on the Arts had a fantastic program called the Art Tank Awards. And it was like Shark Tank. And what you did as an arts organization or an individual artist, you applied. And then if you were selected as a finalist, you presented and you pitched your idea in front of a panel of judges and an audience. And so the founders of Rising Youth Theater, which is myself and Sarah Sullivan and Ashley Hare, we pitched the light rail plays as an idea. And we won. We won $10,000 to produce the first light rail plays. And now we are about to have our fifth light rail plays in December.
Was that $10,000 from Mark Cuban? No. No, that's ridiculous.
You know what? Actually, this program doesn't exist anymore because it was a part of a special allocation of funding to the Arizona Commission on the Arts that was unfortunately cut. But I think it was really, it was a really amazing way to get arts organizations to think about what else could we do to participate in our communities better.
So lots of pop culture. I mean, this is pop culture. Is that fair?
I would say it is probably youth-driven, justice-driven pop culture.
Ooh, okay. So this is, and the best pop culture, right, does try to deliver a message while wrapped in that shiny candy coating of pop culture, right? So,
yes.
So what do you think? What percentage of people get it?
Well, I think the feedback that we hear a lot is that young people's stories are illuminated or visible or legible in a way that is surprising to people, particularly to adults. And that's always really exciting feedback to get, is when we're working on centering young people's stories and experiences, and then an adult says, yeah, I never really thought about that before. That perspective makes sense to me. Like, I hear that. I see you. Like, that's, I think that's radically exciting.
That's pretty awesome. Paula, we talked a little bit earlier about the impact that this has in terms of creating community around the light rail. And you know, lots of people say, I don't know what to expect when I ride the light rail. And they certainly aren't going to expect this. But that's part of the magic, right? And how you build community. So you want to talk a little bit about that?
So the magic works by riding the light rail and just, like, having people see it. By the end of the night, I've met a lot of people that actually enjoyed it, and they were not expecting what was happening. Like, they were not expecting this.
Isn't that the best compliment when somebody says, like, wow, I totally didn't expect that, and it was awesome?
Yeah, it feels amazing because they actually, I feel like our voice and our stories were being heard, and people are actually getting it. Because a lot of our stories have to do with, like, situations that are happening around the community and things that people are not seeing or things people are afraid to speak about. So it's a really good way of getting the word out and getting people engaged in the community.
You're really facilitating understanding, right, amongst groups who wouldn't necessarily connect over those issues. Is that correct?
Yes.
Well, that's one of the really exciting things about the Light Rail as a site of engagement and performance is it's a place where there are all different kinds of people who might not usually talk to each other in one room or car or however you want to frame that box that we're riding down the street in.
That's what I've always loved about public transit. I mean, I think, but so it sort of takes a certain amount of curiosity or at least somebody to engage you with that curiosity. And that's really one of the keys too. That's one of the magical parts about the Light Rail play, right?
Absolutely. One of my favorite parts of our process is when we start the research process and the artists go out and just talk to people on the trains. And people are always so largely delighted to be invited to sort of look up and have a conversation. And people come back with the most incredible stories and images. And we ask people, like, what books they're reading, if they're reading on the train, and why they read that book, and just those little moments of connection.
Are those built into the script of the play? Do you guys look for that?
Yeah, it's built into our research process, and sometimes, and you know, all of that stuff accumulates, and then it sort of like accumulates in a pile and then like funnels down into these plays.
Okay, so it's probably not all unicorns and puppies. You probably have had your fair share of interactions on the train where people were like, leave me alone.
Absolutely. Yeah.
How do you guys handle that stuff?
We're very respectful of
that.
Yeah,
leave them alone.
It's a shared space. It's a space for everybody. If somebody's having a terrible day and they don't want to have a singing performance in front of them or a giant puppet pass them by, that is okay.
A giant puppet.
There's
puppets.
So as people are being transported to work, they are being transported in their perceptions. So, for folks who are listening, how in the heck would one encounter a Light Rail play? What do you have to do? You don't buy a ticket. Well, you do, but not a ticket to the play.
Well, you buy a Light Rail pass, and you can reserve a spot on a tour. And so we actually are going to be performing the second weekend of December this year. And we are shifting a little bit where we're performing. We're still figuring out exactly which platforms we're going to be on, but we're going to be doing all platform pieces this year. And we will move from platform to platform, hopefully going all the way from downtown Phoenix to Mesa.
Wow, that's tremendous. So you're getting a little more ambitious.
I think, you know, we did the same loop of Roosevelt to Camelback for the last 4 years, and now our artistic ensemble is asking, so what is the next part of this Light Rail journey?
Okay, so I only bought a Light Rail pass to get on to this play. How is your work being funded?
Well, our work is funded through a combination of government grants and foundation grants. We have a lot of really amazing individual donors. We have, how else are we funded?
Selling making new theater shirts.
We got merchandise, people.
Yes.
Yeah, but it's largely through grants and donations. And it's really a big part of the philosophy of our organization that we want everyone who wants to have access to a theater experience to feel like not only like they have access to it, but they are welcome and invited to participate in the process and the product. So we collect donations at all of our shows. And we have found that we even out, like we make the same amount of money in donations as we would have in ticket sales. So extending that kind of welcome and not formally charging ticket prices, but inviting donations actually is completely the same as charging tickets from a company perspective.
Well, how cool is that?
It is really cool.
Okay, lightning round questions. Paula, what is the most exciting thing that's ever happened to you during a light rail play?
The most exciting thing that has happened to me was when I was working with puppets in a dressing rehearsal. And we were just performing, and some guy just comes and sits on the chairs that we're using. And he just sat there without knowing what was going on. And the puppets were like almost on his face. And he was just like enjoying laughing. And it was just so amazing.
That's awesome.
How he still had no idea what was going on, even though the things are like right there where he was.
All right. Question number two, Xanthia. What's the best piece of feedback you've received as a result of a light rail play?
In our second year, we were in a dress rehearsal also. I guess all the interesting stuff happens in dress rehearsal. And we were on the train, and a young gentleman handed a little tiny piece of paper to one of the artists as he was getting off the train. And it was like a piece of a receipt, and it said, "It takes guts to do nifty shit."
That's awesome. Okay, so end of lightning round. That was quick. How do people find out more about Rising Youth Theater? What can they do to support Rising Youth Theater? And if they're interested in experiencing a light rail play for themselves, how do they find out where to go and when?
You can find us at risingyouththeater.org. We're also on Facebook and Instagram. And we will be having the fifth year of the light rail plays the second weekend of December.
Well, that's awesome. All right. So risingyouththeater.org. Get all your details there. For those of you who are like me who just can't wait to see what this is all about, make sure you go to Instagram and check it out so we can get some good looks at what this is like. Thank you both very much for being here today. It's been a true pleasure. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thank you.
Also, look on the website for auditions because anyone can come and audition.
That's it for today's episode. Thank you to our fantastic guests for their insights. Thank you to Groove Spoon for lending their very groovy music to us. And a huge thanks to you for listening to this edition of The Vitalist Spark. Here are a few things you can do to keep our spark alive. First, give us your feedback. Rate our podcast on your favorite podcast provider, whether it's through iTunes, Stitcher, or Overcast. Even better, use your podcast app to share your favorite Spark episodes on social media. Most importantly, learn more about what Arizona is doing in the world of well-being and health at livewellaz.org. And don't forget to connect with all of Vitalist Health Foundation's work at vitalisthealth.org. Don't forget, the more we connect and collaborate to improve well-being in Arizona, the more successful we will be. Or, to twist the words of Spider-Man's Uncle Ben, with great responsibility comes great power. We'll see you back on the road to well-being soon.